This is the homily for the fourth Sunday in Ordinary Time, 2026, at St. Anselm's Abbey. The readings for the day's Mass. For the book of the prophet Zephaniah, chapter 2, verse 3, and chapter 3, verses 12 to 13. The first letter of St. Paul to the Corinthians, chapter 1, verses 26 to 31. And the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 5, verses 1 to 12. The homilist was Father Gabriel Myers.
The King James Bible, published in 1611, was once strong in the collective memory of all who speak English, but it is hardly used today. Catholics especially see the flaws in the KJV, the King James Version, or King James Bible. Because of its imperfect scholarship, they did not have the manuscripts we now have, and often translated words differently from the way we would, calling presbyters, priests, elders, calling the church, the congregation. And also Catholics would see the flaw of its bias in favor of the church imposed on his subjects by the strongman leader Henry VIII, who is like some of political leaders in our world today. Yet even Catholics will have to agree on the King James Bible's literary excellence. It fortuitously arose just at the time of Shakespeare and uses his language. The KJV gave to our English-speaking culture over 500 idioms, clever phrases which are still somewhat understood, though just barely, in a post-Christian secular culture. Let there be light, we say, when flicking on the switch. A ram in a thicket, when we make a lucky find. He is a man after my own heart, was said about David, and we might say about someone catching our eye on a dating site. A thief in the night is someone who startles us by jumping out of a hiding place. To heap burning coals on your head is to kill you by kindness. I could go on. I will just mention a monk in our cemetery. In 1994, we were watching the funeral of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, a Catholic who loved English literature. In the Mass, at the time of the responsorial psalm, the King James Version of "The Lord is my shepherd" was used. So we heard archaic language, and there was no chalice. My cup runneth over, Psalm 23 said. This monk, who shall remain unnamed, shook his fist at the TV and said, "Use the lectionary." I am a curmudgeon for the other side. I lament the dumbing down of culture and the flattening of language. I believe that the disappearance of collective memory of the sort I was talking about allows toxic waste to fill the vacuum of our brains, leading to nasty catchphrases instead of poetry, "liberals should die," or "Republicans always lie," which is heard on our news channels, I think in every program, and which much of America seems to live by. In this room, we of course aim to be more subtle, but most of us are on one side or the other of that divide. Back to modern Bible translations with a mediocre style. In 1970, the heyday of new Bible publications, I had several Bibles, the RSV, Revised Standard Version, as the standard because it was a descendant of the KJV, the Jerusalem Bible, which was poetic and came through a French original translation. It was poetic, but wrongly allowed the use of the divine name, which Jews won't utter. And I think that was a big mistake. And then I had a blue paperback, the New English Bible. The poet T.S. Eliot disapproved of this translation, even though he was first asked to be on the committee, but all the churches of the British Isles cooperated on this New English Bible, including the Catholic churches. And this translation gave two memorable phrases that are possibly superior to the KJV. In the revision of 1990, so it's now called the Revised English Version, not the New English Version, one of these phrases was lost. The one that was kept was the first line of Mary's song, which is sung at East Vespers. Instead of, "My soul magnifies the Lord," New English Bible translated, "Tell out, my soul, the greatness of the Lord. Tell out, my soul, the greatness of the Lord." 10 syllables, the exact rhythm of Shakespeare, and a nice hymn derives from that line. The line sadly expunged in 1990 was the first Beatitude. In 1990, they went back to "Blessed are the poor in spirit." But in the 1970 version, Jesus began his Sermon on the Mount, "How blessed are they who know their need of God." How blessed are they who know their need of God. This is a poetic line. The alliteration of "know" and "need" is very nice. The ending sounds of "need" and "God" are also very nice. And this line is superb iambic pentameter at the level of "when in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes," the beginning of Sonnet 29. But I thought it also has a lot to say content-wise. Poor in spirit does not mean depressed, cast down, or overwhelmed. It recognizes, however, that we humans are broken, imperfect, frightened, and that death always threatens us. So we need God to proceed hopefully and to survive. The line also acknowledges that none of us are ever 100% sweet, humble, virtuous, but that we can grow into our rightful destiny when we know our need of God. This is the first step towards freedom and sobriety and a real relationship with our higher power. We do not need to be addicts or 12-step members to perceive that in some situations we will not make it without supernatural help. How blessed are those who know their need of God. It is a line of beauty and perfect truth. So to be needy, and needy of God, why has the official church so often behaved arrogantly, not humbly, forgetting its need of God by claiming, "You must believe our way or you will go to hell"? Why has that attitude prevailed through so many centuries? It is not so long ago that the church, Christ's body on earth, burned heretics at the stake and imprisoned Galileo for telling the truth about earth circling the sun. Vatican II in the 1960s was the first church council not to issue anathemas or condemnations against other Christian denominations and against secular governments. Vatican II was the first to invite the modern world into our exclusive chambers. This has not been without problems. We now know that. But it was long overdue, and I think, overall, a very good thing. I blame St. Paul, rather wrongly, I admit, I blame St. Paul for some of the arrogance and finger-pointing. St. Paul, bless him, passionately evangelizing to the ends of the known world and breaking the prejudice against Gentiles, had maybe a little too much influence in church history. There were so many beautiful insights Paul had. Nothing can separate us from the love of God. We have this treasure in earthen vessels. Love suffers long and is kind. Oh, the depths of God's wisdom, unsearchable and inscrutable his ways. If only he had stopped there, instead of committing to the devil debaters on the other side from him, or consigning wives to the kitchen and centuries of domestic violence. Scripture, including St. Paul, needs sifting and interpreting. Cultural conditioned assumptions must be sifted out to find eternal truths. Moral power must be exercised judiciously, not on baseball cap slogans. Intentions must be honored if two sides are to find a safe and harmonious middle. If we do not find a way to reach across the aisle, I really expect the globe to self-destruct in two centuries, even though I won't be here. All that beauty and all that human greatness gone. Christian values, such as are expressed in the Beatitudes, Christian values, if they are not nationalistic, if they are not censorious, if they are not intolerant, if they respect choice and conscience and difference from our beliefs, Christian values, if they protect and do not terrorize the marginalized and displaced, that sort of Christian values could fend off apocalypse and maintain unity in the world with diversity. This kind of Christian values means letting go on each side of some idolatrous obsessions, and it means standing up for human dignity, even if the person differs from us. How overwhelming such a project is. We must come out of our fortresses and do the risky thing of reaching our hand across the aisle. We must risk living in Minneapolis. Tell out my soul the heartbreak of the Lord, for heartbreak is the only path to God's greatness. How blessed are those who know their need of God. We feel that need desperately for a God who often seems absent, a God who often seems powerless. Footnote about polarization in the church. For Christians are divided as fiercely as Republicans and Democrats, and even Catholics are divided as fiercely as Republicans and Democrats. We can consider the suspicion separating the two apostles who came together to found the church. Yes, there are 10 or 11 more apostles. But Peter and Paul are really the ones who spread the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. We sing that as a joyful antiphon in this room the morning of June 29th, the day when both apostles were martyred in Rome, which was the Washington, D.C. of its time, in the year 67, 34 years after Jesus died in Jerusalem. Peter and Paul spread the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Peter and Paul died to prove that Jesus was and is more alive than they or we are. They left us that treasure. But Peter and Paul also, like the wicked stepmother at Snow White's christening, bestowed a legacy of conflict. Both did not spread the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Peter, chosen by Jesus to be the church's rock, would have stayed in Jerusalem, converting only Jews to the gospel. Paul, the renegade upstart, believed his theories superseded what Peter knew, and he won the battle. Peter lost at the first ecumenical council, and Paul prevailed with his outrageous claim that resurrection is for everyone, not just for patriotic Americans or male supremacists. So their endings, the way they met death, are important. They died on the same day, but they did not die together. They were not holding hands. Each preferred being apart. Peter died on Vatican Hill, and Paul outside the city walls. Peter, more aware than Paul of how blessed are those who know their need of God, tried to wriggle out of this situation and slipped out of the city by night. How mortifying it was for Peter to meet Jesus with a cross on his shoulder going the opposite direction into the city. Quo vadis, Domine? Where are you going, Lord? I am going to be crucified a second time. This must not be. Peter was often shallow and stupid and said things like this must not be. But here he rose to the occasion, snatched the cross, and ran to the gladiator pit, insisting on being crucified upside down to show his unworthiness. Paul was different, having used his tongue and his pen as swords, very pointy. It was fitting that he lost his brilliant head on the chopping block. Paul knew his need of God in this moment. On June 29th, we also sing the antiphon, Glorious are the Apostles of Christ. They loved each other in this life. They were not separated in death. It is not Shakespearean pentameter, but it is very beautiful. They loved each other in this life. They were not separated in death, going back to David's lament for Saul and Saul's son Jonathan. David, in that elegy, bestows equal beauty on an enemy, for Saul tried to kill David, and for his beloved friend Jonathan. Saul and Jonathan died as losers in an unblessed battle that Saul had botched. In this life, we do not always love each other. Saul versus David, Peter versus Paul. But we can respect and give dignity to our enemies. May we come closer to them in this life so that we will be together in heaven.